Before we get started, I've got to tell you about three great companies. PickClick is the first. It's a one-person startup from my friend Ryan in San Diego. PickClick gives you a visual way to search eBay, Etsy, and other sites. Ryan is already doing 1 million product sales per month on PickClick.com. Not hits, but sales. Go to PICCLICK.com to see how he's doing it. 99 Designs, it's the largest crowdsourced marketplace for graphic design. When I used them, I wrote a description of the design I needed and how much I wanted to pay. I got a bunch of designs back. I gave each designer feedback. I picked the one I liked best, and that's the only one that I paid for. Try them for logo design. If you need a blog designed, use them. If you need app icons, use them. There's so many different reasons why you might want to use them. Check out 99 Designs, and you'll see why so many past Mixergy guests have used 99designs.com. And Grasshopper. I've had them now as my longest sponsor for a reason. Not only does my audience love them, but you might have heard several guests here on Mixergy say that they use grasshopper.com as a result of these messages, and they love it. It's the virtual phone system that entrepreneurs like me love because it offers us multiple extensions, music on hold, call forwarding. It gives an impression of having a big professional organization, but also caters to your need to travel and to be flexible. Check out grasshopper.com. Here's the program. Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. Today I've got a guest that's been, actually, Sean, you're the most requested guest here by other guests. I think Heaton Shaw, who I interviewed, asked me to have you on. I can't even think of the list of people, but your name has come up a lot in my interviews, and I'm so excited to have you on here.
Well, thanks, Andrew.
Sean Ellis is the secret marketing weapon behind startups that have had incredible growth. Here's a partial list of the companies he's helped. This is partial. Dropbox, Eventbrite, LogMeIn, Lookout, Zobni. Incredible list. He has a systematic, metrics-driven approach to marketing. Sean, welcome to Mixergy. I want to understand that systematic, metrics-driven approach.
Sure. Thank you. I'm excited to be able to share it with the viewers
or listeners. I want to understand the steps you take a startup through. And I thought the way we could do that is to ask you about the rough outline that you use when you approach a startup. And then we'll go in and put some flesh on that outline by talking about how you applied those steps with companies that you worked with in the past. So can you give us the rough steps?
Sure. Yeah, and it's been a bit of a moving target on what exactly those steps are. A big part of my motivation over the last couple of years has been to figure out those steps and to refine the steps. So this is a snapshot of where I am now, which is essentially I'm gonna start with, as any sort of good startup would, is to state the problem that I was trying to solve and then to sort of show how the solution of these steps has come in. And so basically, one of the big things that I recognized after running marketing at two startups for about over a 10-year period, both of them did really well. And coming off of the second one, we just filed for an IPO listing, and really looking at that second one and trying to figure out, okay, I could jump into another startup, but I was honest enough to realize that I had some pretty good things that were in place there that allowed me to be successful. And so for me, part of it was making sure that I tried to figure out what are those elements in the first place to where I can be successful. And I think a lot of marketers don't spend enough time thinking about that. And so you get some really talented marketers that fail because they put themselves into the wrong place. So at first I didn't realize what this was, but what now is of sort of each of those phases that I take a company through or that I need in place, one of the most important is that they need to have what a lot of people call product market fit. And basically without product market fit, let's kind of talk about that in more of a, we'll go into the details. You wanted me to take a high level first. So,
yeah.
Basically, at its very essence, product market fit is that somebody's got to need the product at all. And if nobody needs the product, then great marketing tactics really aren't going to work very well. So that's first thing that I'm looking for, is just trying to find opportunities where people actually need the product, and then hopefully they reflect big enough markets that we're not going to hit saturation in too short of a period of time.
Okay, so that's the first thing that you do.
That's the first thing that I'm looking for. I actually, to me, I think that's the riskiest part of any startup is actually creating something that matters to people at all. And I actually avoid that space because that's something that to me is really, it's really up to the founders of a business are really well rewarded for figuring that out. And if they can't, then that's okay. Part of, you know, they may have to hit the restart button and try again, and a lot of founders don't find that success until the third or fourth business. But for me, my expertise is not in creating something that people want. I don't consider myself to be all that visionary, and so for me, it's more about finding something that gets that early validation. And you don't need a ton of growth at that point. You just need some early feedback that says, I consider this product to be a must-have. I would be very disappointed without this product. If you have enough people saying that, then you have that core element that says, wow, with the right execution, we'll be able to build a real business on this. And that's the point where I come in. And I think the problem that you have with a lot of businesses at that point is, one, it takes a lot of patience potentially to reach that. You might the first version of your product, you may come out and you may nail it, and then it doesn't take a lot of patience. But more often than not, it takes a lot of iteration, a lot of patience, and keeping burn really low until you get to that point. And then you have to shift into this mode of, all right, it's growth mode. It's time to actually try to move this business forward.
Okay, so if they don't have that product market fit yet, they're not ready to work with you. Once they have that, then the conversation can begin, because at that point you have the expertise to help them grow.
Right, exactly. Okay.
Let's assume then that you've got somebody who's at that stage. They've got a product with the right fit, but it's still early stage. What do you do next?
Right. So then the next thing is, potentially you could go and you could just try to grow that business. And what you would do is you'd have a really hard time trying to grow that business. And I've learned that the hard way. In the early days of LogMeIn, we created a product and I went out and tried to build channels to grow that business. And I really hit a wall pretty quickly. We just could not find very effective ways to acquire new users in a sustainable sort of way. And part of that, when you looked at the conversion process, was that it was very inefficient. We were losing people. For every 1,000 people who hit the website, there may only be 10 people that were actually getting to a good experience with the product. All the money you spend, if you're paying to acquire users, is to get people to the website, and all the value that you unlock in your return on that investment is based on your ability to give people a good experience. And we were really bad at that. So traditionally, a marketer sort of says, I need to, you know, maybe I'm going to work on the messaging a bit. That falls within the domain of most marketers. And maybe I'll even do some landing page testing. And that's still within the domain. But basically, once I get that surface level things, the product is what the product is. That's sort of outside my control. And now I'm going to go out and try to grow this business. And it's really hard to do without an efficient conversion process. And so for me, a big part of what I learned at LogMeIn and what I tried to take to companies afterwards and really specialize in and get better at was, how do you take a product that's good and take the on-ramping of new users and have a really systematic way of getting that to where you've got very efficient on-ramping of new users? And sort of the first step in that is messaging, which I touched on. So most marketers know that messaging is important, but one of the things that I've really learned over the last couple of years is how important, it's not just messaging that drives conversions, it's actually messaging that reflects why people love the product. So you need a certain amount of calibration in that a lot of people just don't look for. And I didn't. A lot of things that I'll talk about today are things that through my first two start, definitely in my first startup, I didn't do at all. And the second, I got a bit better at it. But really, each startup that I've worked with, I've gotten better at each of these elements. So getting through the big picture really quickly is kind of going back, okay, product market fit is the essential piece that you need to build a business. And then it's this period of transition where you need to figure out a good, efficient conversion process that starts with messaging. And so that's really the first project that I do with a lot of companies is, one, help them figure out why do people consider this a must-have, and how can we build messaging on...
So it starts with messaging, and then it goes to on-ramp, and then what else is there? want to just go top view and then
top
we'll dig
down. But, okay, so the messaging that, that reflects that good experience, and then the fine-tuning of the funnel that, that delivers that good experience. And then to some degree within there, you need to layer in the economic model that allows you to fund growth. And so, but all of that is based on an understanding of why the product's a must-have and the benefits that people are getting out. So then you've got the economic part. So those are really the critical things that you need to have in place before trying to grow the business.
Okay, so let me see if I understand this.
Okay.
Company comes to you, you want to make sure that there's a right product market fit. Great product. The few people who are using it see it as a must-have, and maybe those who don't yet know about it would see it as a must-have if they were introduced to it. At that point, you say, it's time for us to start marketing it. That's what I'm great at. The first thing you do is you help the company with messaging to help them explain what it is that they've created. Then you help them with the on-ramp to get new people into the funnel, right, into the system. Then you help clarify the funnel to make it into as efficient a process as possible. Then you make sure that there's an economic model on top of it so that they can, for example, go out and spend money on advertising and grow the business through advertising and know that the profits will be there. Or if it's viral marketing or if it's SEO, you want to know that there's enough of a conversion rate through your funnel that you could afford to spend time and resources to tweak SEO or to tweak your viral marketing.
That's a really good point that you bring. Yeah, just you bring up one important point that ultimately how you layer that economic model in that phase, you need to have a pretty good idea of how you're going to try to grow the business. It may not play out exactly the way you think it is, but if you think this is a business that's going to primarily grow virally, then you can have a relatively low friction, low cost or low value per user on sort of a lifetime value level, and you can still build a really good business because viral marketing is essentially no cost on the customer acquisition side. So you can have a relatively low revenue per user to support that. If you're going to arbitrage growth through search engine marketing or through radio advertising or through something that's going to have a relatively high acquisition cost per user, then you really need to obsess on an economic model that is going to give you a high revenue per user that's going to fund those channels.
Okay. All right. So let's put some flesh on this. The guys from Dropbox, they came to you. What do they have at the time?
So this was I started working with them about the week of TechCrunch. And I can't go into a lot of details on a lot of companies because I'm under NDA. But my NDA does say that anything that they've said publicly, I can repeat. So. Okay. Drew's been really open, so it's actually they're a good company to talk about. So one of the things that Dropbox had that was really good was a very easy to use system where people could install it however you're articulating the benefit of what they delivered, essentially if you installed it on multiple computers, you were able to synchronize your data across those computers.
And Dropbox is that hard drive in the cloud. When they came to you, they already had the hard drive set up in the cloud.
Yeah, the product was pretty close to what it is now. I mean, they've done some tweaks to it, but it was pretty close to what it is now.
Gotcha.
And the early users on it loved it, and so they had basically the piece that I would say they had product market fit. They had some early users that came in. They were pretty creative about bringing in a lot of users around that launch, and so. To me, probably the biggest value that I gave to Dropbox was that it's very tempting to listen to all of the marketing experts that are out there who essentially say you need to be in a category, you need to position this product in a way that that you can bring in a lot of new people. And the closest category to Dropbox when they came out was really either backup or cloud storage. What I was able to help Dropbox do is to really dig into the customer base and understand that wasn't why users love that product. They love that product for some of the other benefits that I just talked about, particularly the synchronization of data across devices, as well as the ability to collaborate on data between two separate people. So they've got a shared Dropbox that's synchronizing between them. And so to me, that's the cow piece that I talked about, that if you're not really tapping into why people love the product in your messaging and in your early experience, you're going to miss the ability to, I mean, essentially what's amazing is that if you message a product as backup, or you message a product as something that's inconsistent with why people love the product, people will use that product differently. They'll come into it and they'll have different expectations about the product. When I started with Dropbox, they basically had very little messaging on there because it was all engineers. And so engineers go one way or the other. They either have lots and lots of messaging that describes every single feature that exists, or they don't have any messaging. And fortunately, these guys had no messaging. And so it was a lot easier to then tap in and only highlight the things that really represented why people love that product, and to keep that calibration going. And then I spent a lot of time with them identifying friction in the early acquisition process of a user and trying to front load the experiences that ultimately created very gratified and loyal users on the product.
All right, let me dig into what you've said so far. First thing is, you said that there was already an audience of people there who love Dropbox. How did you know that? How did you measure it?
So one of the things that I've over time really evolved is my surveying ability at my first company, Uproar.com, through the mid-90s. It's a pure A-B testing company where we did no surveying. Log me in, we got better at it, and just over time I've gotten better. But one
Uproar was, we've talked about these two companies that you work with. Uproar was an online gaming website, right?
Right. Uproar was an online gaming website.
And Log Me In allows you to log into your computer from anywhere, so that if I forgot some file on my desk at work, or I needed to adjust something on my desk at work from my computer at home, I could log in and do it. So those are the two companies that you brought up so far. Going back to how you knew a Dropbox that was passionate.
So I basically, it's a question that I came up with when I was at Zobni earlier, but it's one that's become really important with everything that I'm doing, which is basically asking the early users on the product, how would you feel if you could no longer use this product? And what I'm really focused on is the users who say they would be very disappointed without the product, and learning everything I can about those users and really ignoring everybody else.
So how did you do that at Dropbox? How did you even get to ask those questions?
Well, Dropbox had enough early users where we had a really big survey sample group. So we were able to send a survey out to users anyone who's curious on the key questions on the initial survey that I send out, I have a template online that's at survey.io that lists those questions. But the one important question on that survey, or the most important question, is that how would you feel if you could no longer use this product? And what I find, without going into the specific details of the answers on the Dropbox survey, what I find is that people who, there's two interesting groups. One is the people who say they would be very disappointed without the product. They give really the key nuggets of, that's the value that we've created, and how do we really tap into that value to grow the business. There's a second group in the people who answer, I would be somewhat disappointed without this product, that have some pretty interesting information. And the biggest thing that I see on the somewhat disappointed group is, or the most important thing is, a lot of those people are, because I have a follow-on question that asks why they selected that. A lot of the people who say somewhat disappointed, they refer to, I would just use product X if this one wasn't available. And so depending on the attribute that they're focused on, if they're focused on something that the initial product uniquely offers, there is no product X. If they're focused on something, and so if you take the Dropbox example, the normal pressure that a lot of people gave me and you know, marketers in general are told to position on existing categories, the existing category would have been cloud storage or backup, and that's a really tough, crowded space. But what I was seeing consistently in a lot of companies, again, without getting into the details of Dropbox, is people who say, I would be very disappointed, or how would I feel without this product? I would be somewhat disappointed, and the primary benefit that they're getting is usually something that a lot of other products can give them. And so it's a commodity attribute that basically makes it a very not very defensible business, and not one that drives a lot of sort of must-have user passion.
I see. So if you're asking this question, how disappointed would you be? And a lot of people are saying somewhat disappointed, and you dig in deep and you realize it's because there's an alternative product out there, then you understand this isn't essential enough for this startup to grow. If you're seeing a lot of people come back to you and say, there is no way I could live without this, then you want to find out, what is it about this that's that's making them so passionate, and that's what you
right. And that's what this survey really gives us the ability to segment that initial user group and really tap into why people consider it a must-have. And then there's going to be always a group of people that say, I get no benefit from this product. I would not be disappointed at all if I couldn't use this. And so I just ignore those people. And so part of the process that I go through is a crowdsourcing process where essentially the company's created something, they've put it out there. It may completely fail. It may just, you know, nobody likes it. But generally, there's pockets of people that like it for at different levels. And that's what's really great about this early survey is that it gives you the ability to say, here's the group that say I'd be very disappointed. Here's the group that say I'd be somewhat disappointed. Here's the group that say I would not be disappointed. And by focusing on the very disappointed people and really trying to learn what is it about these people and the use cases and the benefits of those use cases, they really hold the keys to being able to build a successful business. And I so one other piece that I've kind of learned now that I've run this survey across a couple hundred companies. I get a lot of just inbound people saying, hey, here's my survey results. What do you think? And so I've looked at it across a couple hundred companies now. What I consistently find is that people in the single digits, very disappointed, so 7, 8, even 20% of the people saying they'd be very disappointed without it, almost all of those companies have a really hard time getting traction and growing their businesses. Once you get around 40% or more, those businesses almost always get traction and sustainable growth. And so for me, that's the piece that gives you at least some level. So if you really drill into why on that, if you consider it a must-have, then you're very unlikely to churn from the product. So they've got this ability to have those early users stick and stay on there. They wouldn't say they'd be very disappointed without it and then suddenly uninstall and stop using it. And so it gives you that sort of sustainability where your early users aren't churning. And then if you're creating real value, then generally word of mouth is pretty correlated with that as well. And so a high level of word of mouth starts to bring in some organic growth that comes on top of that very disappointed line. So even before I come in and work with a company, if they're good at creating a product that makes people consider it a must-have, then you get those two elements together are actually going to give you somewhat of a positive growth curve in the business without any real effective marketing.
I see. So your first goal.
One of my success is being in the right place at the right time by looking for those metrics.
or being good enough that the people who have who've invested in companies that have hit those metrics would send those companies to you to help you grow them.
Yeah, I mean it's sort of a self-fulfilling kind of my deal flow is really good because of the success. My success has been good because I'm looking for those sorts of things. But that doesn't create particularly interesting businesses. That creates sustainable businesses that do okay. Then really the role that I'm doing is taking that growth curve that would be somewhat positive and basically saying if I can take conversion rates from a really low number and suddenly bump those up to a stronger number, now we've got twice as many people at least. So I mean, I've had companies that are 10 times as many people converting to a positive experience through really good funnel optimization. And so now you take that word of mouth that's happening and those people don't stick until they have a good experience. And so that's why it becomes so critical to get that first user experience right, because otherwise you're just wasting all of that positive word of mouth. They're just going to be bouncing off the site. And so getting that efficiency right means that you're getting more of those people to actually come in and stick, which then takes your growth curve up another notch. And so now you're a little steeper on your growth curve. And that's what's nice is that before we've even started to focus on growth, just getting that first user experience right through funnel optimization already starts to steepen the curve. And we definitely saw that at Dropbox as we started to obsess on that first user experience.
Okay, so our first goal as entrepreneurs, as product developers, is to build a product that's so good that when we survey our audience about it, not sell them, not try to grow the audience, but just survey that audience that we already have, our goal is to have a double-digit response rate of people who say, I can't live without this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you gave the example of Dropbox. When I interviewed the founder of Eventbrite, we talked about how he used a different survey. He had just that one question that he asked, which was, how likely are you on a scale of 1 to 10 to recommend Eventbrite to a friend?
Uh-huh. That's a net promoter score.
Sorry?
That's a net promoter score, is that question? But
yep,
yeah,
and we talked about the book behind that, and we talked about a little about the research behind it. Once you get that up, then it's time to focus on the second thing, which is the messaging. And the messaging comes from going back to those people and saying, why? Why did you give me a high net promoter score? Or why did you say that you can't live without this? Right.
Well, one, I want to make sure that I distinguish between net promoter score and the very disappointed number, because I do think that they're actually different. So I would say, for example, that Virgin America probably has a pretty high net promoter score.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at it, it's not that differentiated from other airlines. So in a sense, it becomes net promoter score becomes more important in a relatively undifferentiated category. Where the question that I'm talking about, if you're a brand new company coming into a category that exists and you're not very differentiated, you don't have a chance. So you have to start by being able to create a must-have product. It's not that you don't have a chance, because clearly Virgin America would be an example of a relatively new company that has been successful with that. But to me, I wouldn't put my money on companies being able to come in with a nice-to-have product and a high referral rate, a high recommendation rate, but on a nice-to-have product. I would always put it on the must-have product because of that sticking. I mean, the one thing that a high net promoter score is you're a lot more vulnerable, that if you suddenly burn your relationship with users, that net promoter score could drop overnight. One bad PR move, where if you're a must-have product, you can screw up a lot of things on the relationship with the users, but if they don't have a good alternative, they're going to stick with you. They're going to hope an alternative comes out. So you should definitely maintain a good relationship with users. But I just wanted to separate. I think having a good number on that does generally correlate to a high recommendation rate. So there's some correlation, but I think for a startup, that net promoter score is not as important in the early days. And fortunately, in the case of Eventbrite, they were really strong on both numbers. And so the very disappointed number, to me, is something that is essentially a milestone for the business to basically say, we've created something that's now a must-have, and we can go from that super low-burn, super patient, conservative mode of just gathering feedback where it may take us years to get there to, all right, this is an inflection point in the business where our priorities have changed. We want to start growing this business as quickly as possible. There's a few things we need to do first so that we can efficiently grow the business. And that's the part where I come in that essentially help them get through those things quicker, because I've done it multiple times.
I see. Okay. So you're saying not just survey the audience, but survey to find out how many of them must have the product. And I've heard this this survey identified with you a lot. And I think Kiss Insights actually has this as one of their template surveys that they offer for free that anyone can put on their website.
Yep.
How like the Sean Ellis must have score. We need a good name for that.
I don't know what it is.
So then you found out how many people you found out that there's a significant number of people who are passionate about the product and can't live without it. You want to then find out what it is about them that makes them must have it.
Yeah, and essentially you're trying to orient the whole business around that. So if you can really dig into, so on the survey.io, one of the questions that's on this free template is what is the primary benefit that you've received from this product? And what you're just trying to get sort of some consistent signal around from the people who say it's a must have, what is the primary benefit that they're getting from the product? And the more that you understand that starts to give you some important insights on kind of all parts of the business. Obviously messaging, as I talked about, but also on, you know, what is the part of the experience that delivers that benefit first, and how can you front load that in it? So I think Pandora is a great example of a company that changed the sign-up process, where most companies have a registration form and a series of things that you go through. They basically just had, and I know they switched away from it a while, I think they switched back, but they had a box that says, enter the name of an artist or song that you like. You enter it in there, suddenly you start hearing music from similar artists or that artist, and they've gratified you. You've got a good experience to where they can start to ask you to do more things. So it's when you try to change that radio station that that it asks you, do you want to save that station? And so ultimately, they whether it was through luck or through some sort of a similar process, realized that that's the experience that made people say, wow, this is great. And how could they get that as early as possible? They turned it into a one-step process to get to that experience. And you haven't acquired people until you've delivered a good experience. So I think that's a really important piece to think about, is that a lot of people assign a value to registrations, but a registration is nothing compared to delivering a good experience. If you deliver a good experience, they're going to repeat visit. They're going to tell people about it. They're going to convert to a purchase. There's a lot of benefits that you get from delivering a good experience that some traditional metrics point you in the wrong direction with, things like, oh, I got a registration.
I see. Okay. And I've read you talk about this, the gratification engine, I think is what you call it. What's the gratification engine at KISS Insights? Or KISS Metrics, the same company, two different products?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think we're still figuring that out. But for a lot of businesses, again, I'm under NDA, so I can't go into too much detail under any particular business. But for me, the gratification engine for any business starts with that must-have experience that we talked about. And so the gratification engine is, what's the process of delivering that must-have experience? So
let's talk about then LogMeIn. That's been talked about a lot. What was the gratification engine at LogMeIn?
Why don't we talk about GoToMyPC, one of LogMeIn's competitors? Definitely not in violation of an NDA on some of those things.
A paid user of GoToMyPC. Whenever I'm on vacation and need to access my computer, I log into my computer using GoToMyPC, and that easy. I love it. I'm also a user of LogMeIn.
Yeah, good. So think about your first experience when you ever went there. In the case of GoToMyPC, they did a lot of radio advertising, a lot of probably a lot of word of mouth, search engine marketing. However it was that you first found out about it.
Leo Laporte.
How did you find out about it?
Leo Laporte talked about it on his show.
Okay. So you probably had a pretty high momentum channel that you came through because it was an endorsement from Leo Laporte, and so you're going to come in with a bit more momentum than if somebody saw a banner ad, for example, that was pretty light. But basically, when somebody gets to the website, they're going to see a value proposition on that website that, in the case of GoToMyPC, it will be access your PC from anywhere, and so then someone's going to say, that sounds pretty good. How's that work? All right, I'm going to fill out a registration form. And now GoToMyPC is also going to make you enter in a credit card. So now that you're going to lose a lot of people at that credit card step. And so you can pull out a credit card. Probably 70% of the people are going to drop right at that credit card step. But they've determined that the people who stay are going to be much more likely to convert to a purchase, so it's okay. You know, I'm sure they're very calculated in how they do those things. So basically, you've got registration form, now credit card, then you have to download the software, and then you have to install that software, and then you have to set up your firewall to make sure that it's not blocking it. And so there's no gratification that we've seen anywhere through here. And then you have to go to a different computer and know to go to their website, and then log in there, and then sometimes I'm not sure in their case if you have to download a client on that side, but okay, so they're just pure web browser, and then from that web browser you now are seeing your computer there, the link. Now you're authenticating to get into that computer. You know, you still have to enter in passwords, and then finally,
what you're saying is
you've got
a big
first,
mess, a long process.
Yeah,
that
you finally have your
card.
First good experience. After all of that, you finally experienced the value proposition of accessing your PC from anywhere.
Yes.
So you start 1,000 people on that process. There's probably 10 that have the good experience of accessing the PC, and so however much they paid to get 1,000 people to the website, and some of that's going to be word of mouth and organic channels, ultimately 10 will have, you know, they'll enter actively into a trial. Some of them will say,
let's see if we get that.
Wow, this is awesome. They'll go out and tell some friends, it's all happening. And then you've got some of those people are going to convert to a purchase because they collected a credit card up front. They're probably going to have a pretty high conversion to a purchase. But basically, to me, the gratification engine is really up to that point of having that good gratifying experience. What's everything that happened from that value proposition all the way down to having that good experience, and how can you fine-tune that gratification engine with effective, essentially what the best businesses want to measure everything in that process and do a lot of testing at each step and qualitative research and really understand why people are moving through and ultimately have something that's a very efficient process that hopefully takes what is 10 people who get to that good experience and find a way to get it to 30 people or 50 people. And every time you see a doubling there, it means that every dollar you're spending externally to drive traffic, the effectiveness of those dollars are doubling as well. So there's a lot of leverage in having a very good gratification engine.
I see. Okay. So if we were to compete with GoToMyPC, you and I were to create a new company that would allow people to log into their computers from anywhere, we would say, look at all these friction points. What can we do to remove those friction points? Maybe mm-hmm. what we do is we remove the need for a credit card. We don't need that right. at first. Maybe what we do is we remove the need for registration. We just say, use your Facebook profile to register. Or you don't register at all, we'll email you a link so that you always have access to your account without having to give us your name. And we're just constantly shaving it down by removing steps and maybe making it easier for people to understand the process so that more people get through that funnel.
Right.
Okay, I see. Can you give the example with numbers that you gave me in our first phone call about Log Me In? The numbers.
I don't recall giving any numbers.
But, okay. Of course. But basically, then the bottom line, what you told me was, you spent X amount of money and you couldn't buy any more traffic. You couldn't get any more registrations.
Right.
Essentially, and you suddenly exactly. the same amount of money allows you to grow the number of registrations, and you could keep spending money to grow even more.
If you can get, say, a 10x improvement, just because the math is easy, if you can get a 10x improvement on the number of people that are getting to a good experience, and in that GoToMyPC example, a 10x is not unreasonable if you think of all those points of friction through the process. And now when you go out and you try to spend money to grow that business, you have 10 times, basically, where channels where you were investing a dollar and only getting 50 cents back on that dollar were unsustainable. You would have canceled them. Now those same channels, you're getting $5 back on every dollar you're putting. You're going to pour as many dollars into those channels as possible, and you spread that across potentially hundreds or thousands of channels. You now have a super scalable customer acquisition growth engine because of your very efficient gratification engine, and that's really the mistake that I see most companies make, is that, one, the marketer doesn't really have enough power in the organization to move those development resources to get that first user experience right, and so they skip it, or the marketer just doesn't want to deal with the headaches of that, or whatever the reason might be, that basically companies really don't spend a lot of time. Maybe they'll do some A/B testing on landing pages, but even that is relatively painful on, QAing the pages and all the other pieces, that a lot of marketers even skip that piece, that ultimately they're trying to grow a business in a way that they're very limited in their ability to do that. And so that's why this gratification engine is critical for it. And then the second piece is an economic engine that we talked a bit about already, but if you can find a way that you get double the revenue per user by being smarter about yields. So, like, let's say if you charge twice as much and you find that there's very little price sensitivity on your product, so now charging twice as much, you have the same conversion rate, then now you have twice the average revenue per user, so you can spend twice as much to get them there in the first place. So it really depends on how important, like, one, how price sensitive your users are, and then two, how important a higher average revenue per user is in developing channels to grow the business. Again, if you're a virally driven business, it doesn't matter as much.
At what point do you think it's important to add that economic model?
For me personally, I used to say right from the beginning of the business, but for me, I believe now after product market fit is when it becomes critical, because it adds so much friction to people coming in and using the product that you it, it it's just really hard to get to the point where it essentially, if you're doing it on trials, if you try to survey that very disappointed question for people who are in trials, most trials, you're lucky if you're going to get a 10% conversion to purchase. So you're already basically saying, you're asking people a few days into their trial, how would they feel if they could no longer use this product? A lot of them have already mentally checked out and said, I'm not going to convert to a purchase. So that already puts you down at the 10% rate right there. And then within that 10%, you're looking for that nugget who say they'd be very disappointed without it. So I've found that a lot of companies that are actually able to sell their products still can be in the 20% or 10% of their users saying they'd be very disappointed, even though they've paid for it. So it's, for me, what I'm basically in the early stages, you're just trying to figure out, you're just trying to learn what are the must-have users and use cases and benefits, and that's going to give you all the information you need to grow the business. And the revenue that you're generating from those users really isn't that important, unless, of course, if you're bootstrapped, then you may need to approach it differently. But if you're a VC-backed business, generating revenue in that early stage, so the one big caveat that I would say is that I would never try to grow a business without some sort of revenue model in place. So I don't want people jumping on me and essentially thinking that I'm irrational on that front. To me, it's just really, it's about what are the important goals that you're trying to figure out at each point, and does money help or hurt your ability to figure out those goals?
I see. Wouldn't, though, conversions to payment be a better metric than any survey? Couldn't you create a product that also had some kind of economic model on it, also had something that people would have to pay for, and instead of surveying the audience, say, how many of those people are going to the paid model, and how do we fix it so that more people go paid?
I think what the problem with that is that you start gaming it more, is that you can trick people to upgrade. There's some great benefit behind the hidden door here, and you don't, you know, just be, like you, a Ginzu knife commercial, they've never experienced the product. All they've done is seen the product on TV and a really good salesperson showing them knives or you know, whatever. Like, I think infomercials are a great example that you can get a lot of conversions without an experience. What you're really trying to do is get a lot of people to have the experience and then understand from there if it's a must-have experience or not. So then the one other piece that I would say is, if you have people saying that they would only be somewhat disappointed if they could no longer use the product and it's free, then you already have your answer, that they're not going to upgrade to the paid version of your product. So, you know, at that point, I'm not saying that the very disappointed at 40% is end game, but you can learn that much more quickly than having the economic model in place. And once you get to that 40%, that's the time when you want to start introducing. First, you want to really drill into the information of why, but then you want to introduce an economic model that on two fronts. One other benefit of waiting to do it is a lot of people have this vision of value that they're trying to create. But once they create the product and put it out there, that the value that people actually get from it is very different than what their expectations, what the vision of the original founder vision had been. And it's very painful to change how you charge for your product and all of those things. So it's much better to sort of learn the value that people are getting from the product and then layer an economic model that's sort of perfect over that than to do it on a guess of what you think you might be able to create.
Isn't that a whole new product, though? Because if you ask people what they love about this product so much that they can't live without it, and they tell you, and then you slap a price tag on it, you're going to piss them off. If you add another product...
You should be saying that this is free during the beta period, and you will be charging for it. So there shouldn't be a surprise.
I see. Okay. That way you don't have to come up with another product that you'll have to charge for.
No.
I see.
And you may find that freemium is going to be the right thing in your category where you are going to want a free version and a paid version, but you might find that's not right for your category. And so that's where putting it out there first, getting the feedback will help you determine the right way to charge for it.
Of this whole process that we talked about, what's the part that you're especially good at? Is it increasing conversions?
I think
marketing?
Well, I'd say that there's kind of two places that I've gotten good at through practice and two places that I am naturally good at. The things that I've gotten good at through practice are the messaging and conversion optimization. I don't think I was necessarily talented in those before, but I've done it so many times now that if you think about the metrics feedback that I get every time I do something, I start to see the things that work and the things that don't work. And then there's been, especially on the messaging side, I've read a lot of books on psychology and influence and different things that sort of show how people get their minds around new things that give me the ability to kind of have sequence the process of how do I create a set of context where people are going to be receptive to a promise. So a lot of times a good hook becomes really important there. How do I develop the description on the product that generates conversions the best? What's the layout that tends to work the best? All of those things you can get through sort of qualitative understanding, lots of practice and the metrics to tell you what actually works. And you can say the same thing on funnel to a large degree. The things that I'm particularly good at are the economics in the business that are going to best help that business grow. So are we going to go ultra premium product? And what are the channels that are likely to grow this business? Is that the right approach, or is freemium, or is free trial, and sort of understanding the right economic model that is tied to the benefit people are getting and ultimately how we're going to grow the business. And so that's one thing that I'm really good at. And then another thing that I'm really good at just naturally is figuring out creative ways to grow the business. So I give you an example at Uproar.com in the mid 90s, really looking at, we were competing against Microsoft, Yahoo, Sony that had, so we were in kind of games and game shows. So Sony had Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy and had tons of television cross promotion. Essentially, we're this little company that was founded out of Budapest that didn't have a ton of financing or other things to really compete against these guys on a dollar for dollar basis. But what we had was super talented engineers and creative game makers. And so really looking at how can we grow this business that taps into those strengths, and also looking at the web as, so one of the things that I spotted, so part of figuring out good ways to grow a business is seeing what's working for other businesses. So I think around 1997 was when Amazon had come out with their affiliate program where they were pushing stores onto websites. And so looking at that and thinking, how can I apply some of the things that are working there with some of the strengths that we had, where we ultimately came together and made a little Java game where somebody could put a snippet of text onto their website and we would stream new trivia questions to them, something called Trivia Blitz. And then we had a button on there that said, add this game to your website. And that kind of took them through sort of a viral distribution of this game. And over time, that game, so it's sort of taking the affiliate program of Amazon, but actually adding really entertaining, valuable content to the websites and paying them a referral fee of 50 cents every time they referred somebody to us who converted to play games on Uproar. But 50 cents for a free active registered user at a time where, I think Yahoo as a public company at the time had one of the lowest acquisition costs, and they were $30 per free registered user. We were 50 cents per user on this game that eventually spread to 40,000 websites. That was really the game that allowed us, and this was really like, a lot of things of thinking through. So originally we thought about doing it in the size of a banner, but we knew if we did it in the size of a banner, people would want to charge us typical CPM rates to get it on there. So we did it in the size of what today is like a YouTube video size. And so it just, changed the perception of the sites where they looked at it as, wow, this is great free content and we can make money off of it. And so that put us at a point where we were able to pass all these people with much deeper pockets and ultimately become the number one game site in the world, and then be a lot more focused on every dollar that we complemented those things and put dollars into banners, but we had it down to every dollar that we spent on a banner on InfoSeek generated 32 ad impressions across our network versus 20 ad impressions when we spent money on Excite. And so just being very analytical and careful about how we were spending money and then having really creative ways to augment that put us at in a position where our average acquisition across all channels was below $5, which put us by far the lowest of any publicly traded company during that time. So that's to me the ability to really creatively figure out how to drive acquisitions because is a big strength that I've had. I've purposely ignored it over the last couple of years because it's been a bit of a moving target across startups. It just changes so quickly that what I wanted to do was get really good at those things that will always be important, like funnel optimization and messaging. But increasingly, I'm moving back into also working with businesses on the growth tactics that will really work to drive growth in those businesses. And the last piece that's starting to be pretty interesting with it is that a lot of these companies have gotten pretty good growth hackers into those businesses as well. And so when we get together and can brainstorm growth ideas, and a lot of times it turns out to be the founder of the business that's the one who's really creative about driving growth. I think it's the same kind of DNA that gets you to come up with a good idea in the first place for a business. It's the same sort of DNA in driving growth in that business. And but now that we're doing it across each of these companies that have really efficient conversion processes and really good metric systems in place, that I'm able to start spotting things that are working in one and move it to another and move it. And so essentially each of the companies I'm working with are non-competitive with each other. And so there's this sort of network of learning that's much bigger than any individual company can get. So that partly is because I'm contributing to that network, but it's partly a cross company learning that I think whether that's something I'm particularly good at or a benefit of what I'm doing, it's a unique attribute that I bring to the table.
Hey, Sean, how do you get paid by these companies, by Dropbox, by Lookout, by Zobni?
A combination of cash and equity. If I could do it all for equity, I would just do it for equity.
Really?
I would. The problem is that it's, I mean, just this year alone on exercising options in these companies, by the appreciation that's happened on them, the tax bill that I have far exceeds any cash compensation I've gotten from the businesses. And so it's something that I just don't have deep enough pockets to always just do it for equity, because it's surprisingly the cash flow side is a lot harder than I would have anticipated. I don't think I'm going to be able to maintain the string of successes that I have up to date. And there's a lot of luck involved with that as well. So we'll see how it plays out sort of in the next batch that come through.
So what you're saying is that, let's take Lookout, for example. I keep bringing up Lookout because John Herring's a good friend of mine, and I think he's got a great company there. So you get options in a company like Lookout. Yeah. Options, at some point, you get to convert to stock. When you convert to stock, you have to pay taxes on it, and that's where you have to shell out some cash, and you won't see
it back. Basically, between your strike price on that and the fair market value at the time where you exercise, any appreciation is taxed as ordinary income. And it's a huge amount of money, you can imagine. So I'm my tax bill this year just on option execution. So there's liquidity will probably be years off on this, but it's well into the six figures this year, and just my tax bill plus the amount of money that I had to pay to exercise the option. So it's a lot harder to do this financially than a lot of people would think.
Is there another way to structure it so that you don't have this tax bill?
There is, but I think the a lot of these companies are already VC funded, and they've created some value, so that they're kind of on the back end of being able to essentially exercise the options up front. You know, it's one of those things that the risk is too high to just take it as stock and pay the tax on the stock up front. And anyway, probably someone listening out there can give me advice on a better way to structure it, but I do have a 3-year window to exercise with each company that gives me enough time to basically see that it's not a huge risk in exercising the options at that point.
I see. Wow, I didn't know you had to exercise the options. I didn't realize this was an issue.
Yeah.
Why aren't you a startup entrepreneur? Why aren't you running one of these businesses?
One, because I don't think that's where my strength is. I mean, to me, my strength is on really growing businesses, and that in order to get to the point where you're growing the business, you have to create value in the first place. And I don't have enough confidence in myself to create that value to where I'll never be able to play into my strength. Even though I can get a lot bigger piece of the pie doing it that way, to me, I think the big picture risk is that I'll never get past that product market fit stage with a lot of these businesses, and I'll just be flailing in that area.
But a lot of the lean startup philosophy is about not really creating the product, but starting out by creating the marketing, and then you build the product that people are that the marketing can support. So couldn't you just create a bunch of landing pages, the way Eric Ries might say, see which one of those landing pages really converts well, and then go out and have somebody build a product for you around it?
We'll see how well that plays out. And I mean, it's not that I don't think that those are important parts of a startup, but to me, I think you still need a visionary, that somebody who really tackles a problem we're solving, and you still need to be able to create a solution that is differentiated enough and meaningful enough. There's a lot of pieces that you can't necessarily rely on being able to iterate your way into. Like I think, to me, a lot of the lean startup principles will help a larger percentage of startups succeed, but most will still fail, and that will always be the case. If you could make it so that startups could, if there was a surefire way to create startups in a way that they weren't going to fail, everybody would be doing it, and therefore there would be no opportunities because all the good opportunities would be gone. So it's just, I think I have a much more interesting value to add. Another question I get from a lot of people is, why not work on the VC side? And that's tempting as well, but the number of successful startups a VC kicks out in any given year is too low. I'd rather go cross VC and take the companies that are coming out of each of these VCs and help them. And so that's really ultimately for me why I'm not in the really early stage. Like I think that there's a lot better entrepreneurs that can really drill into that side, and why I'm not on the VC side, because you've got too small of a pool that you're in, and then kind of just in the big picture is that I've figured out some really cool things over the last couple of years, and there's still a lot of really cool things to figure out, and getting these right and sharing them back with the community will result in a lot more startups coming out and being successful. Then I can make a lot more meaning doing this than I can creating one single startup.
And you say too that, I think I've got this right, most startups will fail even with the lean startup methodology that's supposed to protect you from that. How? Why?
Essentially because my feeling on, and this is just me, I mean, obviously I'm associated a lot of times with the lean startup movement, and I think a lot of the things I do are very consistent with it, but I don't consider myself a lean startup practitioner or something. It all works together. There's a right way to do startups and probably a wrong way, and lean startup covers a lot of the right way. But ultimately what I've found, and it's kind of, you know, it's a sort of a, hopefully it doesn't make me look too cynical, but but basically you can put all the right tools into somebody's hands, but it comes down to a good entrepreneur to actually execute with those tools. And not all entrepreneurs are good entrepreneurs. That there's some that are, you put the right tools in their hands and give them the right opportunity, they're going to kick ass every single time or most times. And so I think for those people, following a lean startup process gives them a ton of predictability of success. But most people aren't cut out for it, and myself included. I'm putting myself in that batch that I don't think I'm necessarily able to kick out startups that would succeed on a regular enough basis for me to be in that group. I've never considered myself to be particularly visionary. I'm way too practical, but that helps me connect with sort of ordinary customers of products a lot better and look at things through their eyes, where a lot of times people who are too visionary and too smart have a hard time kind of looking at it through the eyes of an ultimate customer on a real practical level of why are they going to want this and what are the alternatives.
Interesting. So I'm curious, because you've been on the inside of so many companies and you've seen the decisions and you've seen the entrepreneurs from a point of view that most of us don't have. I'm wondering what you think separates the good entrepreneurs from the bad entrepreneurs. And you've given a few answers here. You've said vision, you've said the ability to see the product from the customer's point of view. What else do you think?
So I think one of the biggest things that I see is a lot of times when I speak in lean startup groups, everybody wants more detail. Everybody wants the exact dot-to-dot roadmap of how do I get from point A to point B. If I achieve point A and I'm supposed to achieve point B next, give me exactly the way that I get there, where to me, every successful entrepreneur that I've seen would never ask me that question. They know that part of being a scrappy, successful entrepreneur is figuring out the hard stuff. That, you know, that to me, half the battle is knowing where to be aiming at any given point, and I can give that information, but a good entrepreneur is going to figure out how to get there, and every business is different. So a lot of the things I talk about are principles that can be applied to most businesses, but I was just on the phone right before this with an entrepreneur that had a very different business, and I loved his answers on each part of how he's going to get to each of the targets within his business, and he had a bit of a network effect business that ultimately required some level of critical mass for a product to become a must-have for a group of users, and there was local rollout possibilities there, but those are all the unique aspects of his business. There's no book that's going to give him those answers. He's looking for the edge, but he's also knowing that the opportunity's there because it's hard, because he needs to figure it out and assemble the pieces in a way where he can be successful. And the best entrepreneurs that I see aren't trying to get all the answers out of a book. They're looking for nuggets that they can get in a lot of places, but ultimately they're doers. They're people who just go out there and know that they have complete faith in themselves to figure it out. And that to me is that I would say at least 80% of the entrepreneurs that are like day one trying to start things out don't necessarily have that DNA. Some will get lucky by following the process and they'll do all right. But you know, there's a group of people that if you put the right tools in their hands, they're going to succeed more times than not. And those are the guys that I would bet on more often. And again, I'm not putting myself in that group. The part where I have similarities is on the back end of those businesses where all of those pieces are in place, where I will tenaciously figure out how to help them grow those businesses and use that same ability to figure things out, but knowing that there's not some standard formula I'm going to be able to plug in where it's, oh, this is a category 17 business where it's three parts SEM, two parts SEO, and a little bit of virality, and it's off to the races. That it's much more of thinking, is this a high intent category? Is this an impulsive category where people don't know they need it? Is this something that's going to primarily grow off of word of mouth? Is it something that's going to completely disrupt an existing category where you just need to slightly shift people toward your product? Every business is so different, and it starts with getting into the customers' heads and starting first with creating value in the first place, and then figuring out how can you reach more of those types of people who need that value, and then creatively, how do you connect those dots?
Of all the entrepreneurs that you've worked with, who's the one who just gets it, who gets the process?
I would actually say the one that you mentioned, I would say John Herring, to me is just that classical guy who had really not a ton of experience on the entrepreneur side that somebody would say is classic, you know, bet on that repeat entrepreneur. I mean, he's always done very interesting things, but I would put my money on him every time. I would say Drew Houston from Dropbox, same thing. That he's and Arash, his business partner, I just don't know as well kind of how his mind works on it, but I think that the thing with Drew that separates him out from a lot of people is that he is just so focused on creating value for customers and doing the right thing for customers that he's just created this ecosystem of growth just based on, like, from day one of just what do they really need and how we strip away all the BS in delivering them what they need, and then how do we always do the right thing that's an awesome business. There's just a lot of different guys out there that have elements of it, and there's other people that may get there that I don't know exactly where. I think Kevin Hartsey, you said you had on the program before, is anyone who's a repeat entrepreneur, who's been in businesses one after the other, who keeps succeeding, like I think they always tend to get it. But I mean, that's been a big part of, for me, it's been great to be able to be exposed. Mike Simon, the guy who was the founder of LogMeIn, co-founder with Martin Anka, but Mike founded our previous company together, Upwork.com as well. He's the perfect complement to me, where he's super organized, delivers great, you know, puts a vision out there where investors and other people buy into that vision well, and just an awesome person at execution that, you know, I think an entrepreneur can have a lot of different strengths. Some of those strengths, to me, the hardest part is creating something people want in the first place. And that doesn't necessarily scale into a good business manager that can manage a business with hundreds of employees, but those guys can create really valuable businesses. Mm-hmm. They just may not be the ones that take them to the next level. And then you've got some guys that are super dynamic that can be there day one and take it all the way through to a $1 billion business. And that's where I think a Mike Simon, who runs LogMeIn, is more similar to kind of that latter group. But yeah, I mean, I think every entrepreneur that has success brings a lot to the table. You can't really isolate it down to just a single thing.
No, you really can't. I've now done interviews with 300 different entrepreneurs, at least 300 different entrepreneurs. And you'd think that there'd be characteristics that are just common to almost every one of them, to maybe 250 out of the 300. It just doesn't seem to exist. They're so freaking different. One day I'll have an entrepreneur who says, you got to work nonstop. Every freaking hour you're awake, even in your dream, you need to have something that will get you thinking about your business. Another one will come on. Say, no, come on, Andrew, you need to just maximize the hours you're fully there. Maybe spend 6 hours that you're fully on the job and then take a break so that you can free your mind to think of other things that will create ideas that will help your business grow the next day. Just, it's different, but you can tell, too.
Yeah. To me, I mean, a couple things I'd break it down to is, one, an enormous amount of willpower to sort of execute on a vision, but balanced against being able to respond to the realities that are coming at you about that. And that's where I think a lot of the lean startup stuff is really good, of being able to essentially pivot if something's coming back and saying that's just not viable at all. And so there's a lot of people that if you can will your way into success, there's a lot of people that are gonna overcome a lot of hurdles, but you just can't force a product down someone's throat that they don't want. And so it's a fine balance, because so many people that are going to be so responsive to the feedback aren't going to do it in the first place, because they're going to be too uncertain and timid to ever take the plunge. And so it's just this balance between confidence and ability to go really hard, that sometimes you're in the right direction and you get lucky. And those are the dangerous entrepreneurs to fund the second time. And it's really hard to spot the difference, because they may have just gotten lucky and just blasted their way through, and they can leave the massive craters on the next business, because they'll raise lots of funding and just execute their way into oblivion. But to me, that's the reason why I think I wouldn't be a good entrepreneur from start to finish of creating a really big business, is that I'm too uncertain. I question everything. I analyze everything and step. You know, so to the point where that works great on growth tactics, where it's experimenting across 50 things and having lots of good ideas and killing 48 of those and keeping the two that you can really scale to grow the business. So it works well on that front. But you can't. I don't think as a business you can't execute that way from day one, because it's just there's too much effort created in building the prototypes to ultimately go out, and I would hedge too much, I think.
All right, let's leave it this way. 10 years from now, you're now cultivating businesses, you're helping them grow. Some of them are going to have great exits. 10 years from now, you're going to learn about your personal business, 12 and 6. Where do you see it all in 10 years?
I don't even think 10 years ahead. I mean,
really?
For me, yeah, I, I'm for me, like my biggest drive day to day is, and over the last couple of years has just been trying to really figure this stage out that I think is challenging. And I think my learning curve in certain areas is flattening out, but in other areas I'm just on the front end of that learning curve. And so, I'll probably get bored with what I'm doing at some point and have to figure something else out. But at least for the next year or two, I'm going to just keep doing the same thing. But a lot of my day-to-day drive is just trying to – I just know that the more that I can really understand how you take great technology that people love and a great product on top of that technology and can figure out how to bring it to the masses, that there's an enormous benefit to that, to the entrepreneurs, to the masses, to society in general, that's a fun challenge to be taking on, and something that's I think similar to the challenge of any individual business. But I don't think I'll ever perfectly have the answer. But there's definitely places where my learning curve has flattened out a lot, and I think the next point for me will really be on just how good I can make the network of businesses that now, with so many companies that are in really sharp growth stage, that how much cross-pollination of really good growth discovery engines that I can both help to build in those companies and then help to cross, you know, bring the best ideas. And not everything works in every business, so you do have to sort of compartmentalize and categorize each of those. But my vision, I think, over time is to basically have in every interesting emerging category out there is to have a play in that category where I'm helping them be successful, and that it's a non-competitive network where there's just a lot of I think the things that I wish I had as a marketer in individual businesses where I was very siloed, where I didn't have as much time to really tap into what was working for other businesses because you're so busy trying to figure out what's going to work for your own business, that if I can bring sort of the outside perspective of what's working, but not just from what you pick up in a book, because the best things aren't going to be on books or in blogs. People are going to be pretty protective of them because they get saturated quickly. If you just put them out there, everyone's going to pile into them. So it has to be somewhat of a limited network. But if I can bring at least half the good ideas to each one of these startups, it becomes really powerful, I think, across the board in all of them.
Hey, if you and I were sitting over a beer and talking, would you be more open about some of your tactics? I know that you've got to be protective, and
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that the tactics are always a collaboration, and you know, I'm not coming up with the tactics necessarily on my own. It's, you know, you're sitting around and you're taking them to the next level. That it's just not fair for me to spread them externally to the damage of the companies that I'm working with. I may trade if you've got some good ones. I may have a good open conversation with you where there's something I can bring kind of back to the network, but I wouldn't want to just get. I mean, it's not mine to give up, if that makes sense.
I see what you mean, and I've got to tell you that this is what a lot of people love about you, and it's also what creates your legend. So I get it completely. It's why I could see people like John Herring, who's really quiet about his business, loves working with you, somebody who has a higher profile than. Someone who has a high profile. I understand it. I appreciate your integrity. I'm going to find all kinds of other secrets to bring to our conversation when you and I get together over beer.
Perfect.
But for now, thank you for doing this interview. I'm really grateful that you came here.
Well, thanks, Andrew. It's been fun, and hope we can do it again soon.
You bet. Thanks. Thank you all for watching.